This week's episode is brought to you by Vulgarity S, The Choice, and Kyle Justine. Thank you, Vulgarity S, The Choice, Kyle Justine. It's with the generous support of listeners like you that gives our crew here, the whole rabbit, enough energy to keep telepathically operating our frictionless bullet elevator that runs between our subterranean laboratories and the Seventh Circle of Hell, where our team of intrepid hostage negotiators trade Satan leaders the freshly squeezed breast milk in exchange for ripe bunches of infernal pomegranates we use to bribe the authorities into letting us continue doing this show. If you'd like to help us keep sourcing satanic pomegranates or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you access to the extended version of this episode, but every single one of our extended episodes that once you sign in are able to be browsed from right within Spotify. But that's not all. I'll go a step further and send you an illustrious gourmet 5x5 high quality vinyl custom sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, along with the secret keys to our Discord server, which has a bottomless chlorine free hot tub. If you're enjoying the free show and would rather spend your $5 on a mid-sized polymer spatula, then please consider giving us a like, subscribe, or share on your social media platform of choice, because it helps our humble podcast grow bigger each week and it prevents my eyes from bleeding.
Help, my eyes are bleeding!
On this week's show, we initiate phase 3 of our ongoing tour of the Gnostic Gospels of Thomas from the Nag Hammadi Library. In the free section of the show, we resume our journey at verse 64 and begin to focus in on a number of major themes centered around the virtue of poverty, ego death, and having haters? You gotta have a lot of haters. In the extended version of the show, we continue until line 93 and discuss the devil, the golden section, Gnostic sex acts, disingenuous ritualism, and why Jesus Christ is the greatest rapper of all time. Catch us next week for the harrowing conclusion of the Gospels of Thomas. Thank you, and enjoy the show. So I went running the other day with my Bible. My psalms got sweaty.
Yeah.
Who is the greatest babysitter mentioned in the Bible?
Who?
David. He rocked Goliath into a very deep sleep. Who was the smartest man in the Bible?
Who?
Abraham. He knew a lot. What is a missionary's favorite type of car?
What?
A convertible.
Wow.
That's bad.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just attempt to invalidate religion because we have the dubious notion that myths and metaphors can only be interpreted literally from within the narrow confines of the physical sciences we pretend to know a lot about. Nay, we get pissed drunk on the blood of Christ as we sip the sweet sacramental scissor from his holy pimp grail cup while spitting verses at the Judean haters and dropping bars on the ones in deep cover, because this week we're continuing our discussion of Jesus, the world's first international rap star, as we dive into part 3 of our series studying the Gnostic Gospels of Thomas from the Nag Hammadi Library. I'm your host, Hack Rabbit, also known as Luke Madrid. I'm joined this week by the gangstered out Galilean, Mari Sama.
Yo, 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 what's up, my Gnostic G's?
The anti-myth rhythm rock shocker, Malachor 5.
Greetings, mortals.
I stole that from Zach De La Roca. And the hematic, hydrodynamic heartbreaker, Heka Astra.
Hello. Is this where I say something witty, like eat your heart out?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm really enjoying researching this episode as it goes on, because comparing the Gospels of Thomas to the canonical Gospels sends you on a little trip through all the important revolutionary ideas inside of Christianity. Because, you know, it's a little stuffy, like looking at it from a distance. But once you get up close to it, you begin to see what a world-changing movement it was. It's pretty radical.
Some people might even say it was a radical thing that absolutely needed to happen to humanity to get us to where we are today.
Agreed. Christianity is a little bit like Aleister Crowley that way. Even if you don't like Aleister Crowley or Christianity and don't really know a lot about Aleister Crowley or Christianity, you can't get around the fact that it's completely changed the way the world works and has influenced the present more than you can possibly know.
On purely religious grounds.
And so keep your ears open today. We're going to see little tidbits of the radical Christian philosophy that we now just take for granted. Drawing from our last episode, like No Man Left Behind, everybody knows that's what you're supposed to do. Like if you get in a war, you leave no man behind. You gotta guard your friends like they're the pupil of your eye. I'm also slowly starting to realize that every legendary rapper ever is borrowing from the story of Jesus more than I realized at first. I'm gonna bring it up on this episode quite a bit. All them rappers are just pretending to be Jesus. So let's pick up where we left off last time at verse 63.
Jesus said, "There was a rich person who had a great deal of money. He said, 'I shall invest my money so that I may sow, reap, plant, and fill my storehouse with produce, that I may lack nothing.' These were the things he was thinking in his heart, but that very night he died." Anyone here with two ears had better listen.
You hear that, Zuckerberg? You think that little bunker you're making is going to keep you safe? What about your soul, Zuckerberg?
Oh, man, did you see him, like, before Congress? It was just, like, yesterday or today in the morning, I think.
Oh, I didn't see that, no.
Well, so basically, the American government is coming after Zuckerberg for, like, all this underage interactions that should not be happening. They're coming at him with all these, like, screenshots and, you know, numbers of how many percentages of girls of the age of 12 to 14 are experiencing these awful things. And they're asking him hard questions and grilling Zuckerberg really hard. And he's like, "Have you compensated these families? You billionaire? I'm sure you can." And then Zuckerberg gets up at one point and he turns around and he says he's sorry. It's kind of like, okay, like, good job, dude. But it's like, fuck you still.
He stands up, turns around and says, "Have any of you noticed how round my butt is? Look at this thing." And they just get distracted. He paid for that butt. You really think Zuckerberg was born with a badonkadonk like that? Anyway.
I don't know why you're looking at it.
You can't miss it. Anyway, so back to what Jesus is saying, if nothing else. This verse resembles the old adage, "You can't take it with you," and doubles down on the idea that the world is full of the drunken who, as much as they drink, can never quench their thirst. Clearly, in terms of ancient lifestyles, this fellow had it all figured out. He's got money. He's got property. He's got fertile land, probably slaves to work his fields, storage for the produce he grows. And even these many practical things cannot save you or even provide for you on a fundamental level.
I mean, in one sense, he really did invest everything and received the ultimate payoff. It just wasn't what he thought it would be. If you were to take it to mean a spiritually rich man, then he received what he sowed the next day in the form of absolute spirit.
Ah, but he didn't. So he received death.
Yes.
So don't hoard, kids.
All that toilet paper is not going to save you. So let's take this for example. This is like a truism. We're all told, but most of us spend all day running around trying to get our storehouse in order. I mean, we can say as much as we want about the wisdom of Jesus, but most of us would have a really hard time following this admonition, right? I would.
It's like you get all your ducks in a row and then it's just like, nope, you die. Ducks don't matter.
At the same time, the little people, the peons, I mean, most people don't have any kind of savings in their account. If something really bad were to happen, like the only reason for storing things away and being prepared, or like even keeping a supply of food and extra toilet paper in case people make a run on the shelves again, I don't think that like an average person could go to excess. It's a matter of planning for the future. Whereas I think what is discussed specifically here is someone who does have the means, like they would never go hungry or go without, but for some reason they keep amassing more and more and more that can never feasibly be used, even within their lifetime. It's a waste of energy and it takes away from other people. It hurts other people indirectly.
Yeah, it's kind of like that sad story of the person who worked $250,000 into their 401k so that they can take a vacation, but they died like a week before. You know, it's like she worked for that dream and she never got to even experience it. And that money just kind of goes away. You know, that's happened before. Right here, it's Christ is kind of saying like, YOLO.
It's fun time!
You only live once, in a way. Not saying to be reckless about it either, you know, take all the other lessons in consideration. With ultimate respect to, like, you're only living once, like, you want it to be good, so don't fuck it up, right?
Yeah, use the things, the bounty that you have, even if it's just giving it to other people that are less fortunate than you.
So we've kind of set the stage for how Jesus thinks about the wealthy and the people who toil to have their ducks in a row, so to speak. This idea, once again, gets expanded in the next verse.
Verse 64, Jesus said, "A person was receiving guests. When he had prepared the dinner, he sent his slave to invite the guests. The slave went to the first and said to that one, 'My master invites you.' That one said, 'Some merchants owe me money. They are coming to me tonight. I have to go and give them instructions. Please excuse me from dinner.' The slave went to another and said to that one, 'My master has invited you.' That one said to the slave, 'I have bought a house, and I have been called away for a day. I shall have no time.'"
He's got to get his internet turned on. You can't just...
Because they take all day to come over.
Yeah.
"The slave went to another and said to that one, 'My master invites you.' That one said to the slave, 'My friend is to be married, and I am to arrange the banquet. I shall not be able to come. Please excuse me from dinner.' The slave went to another and said to that one, 'My master invites you.' That one said to the slave, 'I have bought an estate, and I am going to collect the rent. I shall not be able to come. Please excuse me.' The slave returned and said to his master, 'Those whom you have invited to dinner have asked to be excused.' The master said to his slave, 'Go out on the streets and bring back whomever you find to have dinner. Buyers and merchants will not enter the places of my father.'"
Whoa.
Kind of harsh. But yeah, you don't place that before fellowship with a fellow man.
Don't like your landlord? Don't have to see him in heaven. What about that car salesman? Not going to be in heaven either. So are we beginning to see a theme yet? Most people, especially the successful ones that everyone else wishes they were like, are so busy with the numerous distractions and obligations of the world that they're utterly unwilling to commune with the Father, even when invited specifically to share in his bounty as equals. Therefore, as mentioned prior, it is the poor who are blessed and will sit at the Father's table.
Was Jesus a communist?
You know, besides being a rap star, I'm gonna be pointing this out too. I think Jesus was a little bit of a communist.
Well, that's kind of what I explained in the first part to the series, is that the Essenes were communists. They did live in communes and shared everything. So I also said that Jesus possibly was that particular sect of Judaism at the time, because there's a lot of examples of him criticizing the other two sects in Jerusalem very harshly, but he never says anything bad about the Essenes. So Jesus was a communist to me, for sure.
I mean, at the end of the day, the Roman Catholic Church pretty much invented communism with the weird social welfare programs they have been trying to perfect in South America. And then if you look at communism itself, it's just like, instead of Jesus, you have the state. The end. It's the same thing. It's just no God.
So yeah, if we look at like the pyramid with the eye separated from it, that's the idea that like God and state are separated. But when you have the eye attached to the top of the pyramid, that's like communism, that God is the system, is the economy, is the government. And so we have to look at that system only and don't separate it from the divinity. That's what that symbol means. So on the back of your dollar bill, you see an eye separated from the bottom half of the pyramid. It's Illuminati stuff, sure, but it's communism versus capitalism.
Man, in that case, I kind of want the eye hovering above, you know?
Yes.
There's some separation there. You can't just make the state God. That's effed up. Keep the capstone hovering. Thank you. All right, so this verse, though, about the master and the dinner and all that, it happens to be a more straightforward version of a verse that appears in Luke 14 and Matthew 22.
There's also a commentary here in this verse that implies that those who are preoccupied with abundance of the material and manifest natures referred to in the verse as buyers and merchants are incapable of experiencing salvation in the form of a seat at the Father's table. And for me, this is very much like the concept of the chalice of Babylon being filled with the blood of the saints, that blood being you and your multifaceted manifest nature. So these things are sacrificed and poured into the feminine chalice.
This would be the yogic process, which makes the person poor and by extension worthy.
So it is this chalice which is held by the charioteer in the chariot card of the tarot. On the Kabbalistic tree of life, the path of the chariot lies between Bina and Gebura. All paths that connect between the supernal triad at the top to those below it have in common that they must cross a kind of chasm as the divine light continues into manifestations or reflections. So all of the paths which cross the abyss into the supernal triad require sacrifice. The chariot, the high priestess, even the hierophant with his willing circumcision, these are all things that require sacrifice. So with this verse, the Father's banquet table can kind of be thought of as Kether. With the path between Bina and Gebura, you could think of Bina as Hathor, Isis, or the Thelemic Whore of Babylon. She receives all and gives birth to all without discretion. That is the path of the chariot, and it goes both ways. So all is given, all is born. Another path from below the supernal triad that goes straight to the top is between Tifereth and Kether. And I think this verse draws upon this energetic path as well. So that's path 13, and it corresponds to the high priestess of the tarot. The Hebrew letter associated with this path is Gemel. Pretty sure Luke has brought up before that Gemel relates to camel. This path between Kether, crown, and Tifereth as beauty is the longest path on the tree. You could think of it as being a willing transformation which spans across the abyss or non-sphere of Da'at. Da'at is linked to knowledge. And Luke brought up the similarities of this verse with the New Testament book of Luke. But if you jump just four chapters forward to chapter 18:25, where it says, "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God," then I think it applies pretty decently to this verse. And then, as Malachor mentioned in the last show, the serpent path up the tree weaves its way through every path. So when it comes to entering the kingdom of heaven, or, you know, a seat at the table of God's banquet, all of these paths must be traversed.
You know, there is a little bit of Kabbalistic symbolism going on here, because the path of the magician runs between Bina and Kether. Of course, we know a fixture of the Magus card is the table, which represents Bina because it understands what's being placed atop of it. The people being invited are the windbags out there with the poor people, the paupers, the fool, so to speak. That's the other path from Hokma to Kether. Just random people. And then, like you said, the path of Gemel relates to this as well, because the rich man and the camel, etc., etc. How are you supposed to get into heaven? Well, you have to have nothing. You have to be like the fool, you know? You have to follow the path of Gemel, go through the eye of the needle.
And even that path, the path of the high priestess, which crosses over top of the path of the empress and her relationship to the door bolt, all of this stuff ties in with other lines in the Gospel of Thomas with doors being opened that we're going to get into later at some point. So I think this is all very much a Kabbalistic way of understanding what's going on in this verse.
Well, ain't that the thing about Jesus? He's saying the esoteric content, but in a way anyone can understand it, with symbolism and imagery familiar to the normal person.
Yeah, and that symbolism, imagery, or archetypes are found in the tarot cards. So it's why we can relate the tarot to almost anything that we find in this manifested world, I guess.
Well, yeah, the whole Christian world that made these tarot cards uses the symbolism from the Bible and presumably from the non-canonical texts, if they're into that as well, and they're going to combine them all. I mean, that's what the mystery tradition really is at the end of the day.
And with his lyrical genius, Jesus is very much like a rap star, constantly being like, "Hey, you picking up what I'm putting down? Let's go
give it to you." So really, this verse is like what you're saying. You have to give it all up to God so you can make it through the narrow opening into heaven.
And it's said that you have to do that very same thing to cross the abyss. It's like crossing the abyss is like a lower octave of that true contact with, like, the source God, whenever that's supposed to happen. Maybe when you die, or if you do it in life, I don't know.
And if you're doing the serpent path, you're doing all of these paths. So you are the fool, you are the magician, you are the high priestess, you are the empress. You're doing all of these. And there's multiple sacrifices that are made with several of those paths.
It's just like 50 Cent says, "I gotta make it to heaven because I'm going through hell." I'm sorry.
Well, that's word. It's good.
It's the truth.
All right, so now that we've confused everyone with Kabbalah, on to verse 65.
He said, "A person owned a vineyard and rented it to some farmers so they could work it and he could collect the crop from them. He sent a slave so the farmers would give him the vineyard's crop. They grabbed him, beat him, and almost killed him, and the slave returned and told his master. His master said, perhaps he didn't know them. He sent another slave, and the farmers beat that one as well. Then the master sent his son and said, perhaps they'll show my son some respect. Because the farmers knew that he was the heir to the vineyard, they grabbed him and killed him." Anyone here with two ears had better listen.
I love it that a lot of these lines end with "two ears and you better listen," because that's totally rabbit stuff.
Picking up what I'm putting down.
So Van Gogh doesn't have to listen.
No.
He's got one rabbit ear. It's not enough.
You know, I think if we're still talking about the
paths on the tree of life that this plays into what we were just talking about, where it's they don't recognize these people over and over again. So it's kind of this sacrificial nobody becoming none kind of idea.
Now, a longer, more detailed version of this parable does exist in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In the case of the Gospels of Thomas, however, the tale has a dramatic three-part setup familiar to popular folk tales like the Three Little Pigs or Little Red Riding Hood. Presumably, the owner of the vineyard is God, the vineyard itself maybe Israel. The evil renters are the legal and religious establishment, while the servants and the owner's son are like the prophets and Jesus Christ, respectively. The conclusion of the parable in the Synoptic Gospels invokes the rejected cornerstone, which here in the Gospels of Thomas comes in the very next line. Clearly, each book is working from a very similar script.
Verse 66, Jesus said, "Show me the stone that the builders rejected. That is the keystone."
This is from something else too, right? This line, "The stone that the builder refused shall be the cornerstone."
Probably a rap lyric.
I know Sublime says it.
No, I think you're right. That it. I feel like I've heard it before somewhere else. That's not rap.
Isn't it in the introduction to the Boondocks?
"I am the stone that the builder refused." Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's there's a lot to say about that little bit of words.
Boondocks is just about Jesus too.
Probably, yeah.
So naturally, the rejected cornerstone, almost certainly Jesus, who, blessed above all by God, is totally rejected by the Israelites. If we assume the Gnostic perspective of the Thomas Gospels, where an accomplished student of this wisdom becomes one with Christ, then we might also assume this is true of all the early Christians who were likewise treated as rejects, fed to the lions, etc. So what about the cornerstone? Well, regarding this exact idea, according to Hippolytus, the Nicenes spoke of the archetypal heavenly man, whom they called the Adamas, as their chief cornerstone.
Just to throw in some Kemetic relations, Adamas or Adam is comparable to the archetypal heavenly firstborn Atum, who in completion of birth is Nefertem, which we talked about last episode. Just as the biblical Adam is made in the image of God, we see the birth of the divine child Horus reflect the self-created virginal birth of Atum. So relating the divine child Horus to Jesus and Atum to God, we also see that the two are unified through knowledge. This notion is parallel to the Gnostic Adamas, where Adamas is unified with perfect knowledge as his consort. This also happens to be parallel to the Kephar to Tifereth connection of the high priestess and the long path through Da'at as knowledge. The memes converge pretty decently.
Which is an interesting line to finish on, because there's some ideas converging in my head right now. I think this is what the whole Rock of Ages thing is. And if you don't know what that is, it's kind of like how God is like a still an unmovable object. It's like you refuse this rock, but it still is going to come back and become like a foundational part of the whole structure. It's just part of the nature of God. It's almost like this first arising. It's that idea again of just like, well, you refused me. I was kind of like in the nothingness, but I'm still going to rise up out of this mound idea, this rock. And it's like kind of, that's what the Rock of Ages is.
You could also kind of think of it like we are all rejected cornerstones having been cast down from heaven into this material existence.
We'll be bringing it up again later, but Adam Kadmon or Adamas or whoever you want to think of it, he's the keystone, he's the foundation, because that's like the soul we all got split off from. Like all of our roots are in Adam, according to the Gnostics. And even, you know, according to mainstream Christianity, it's just that to the Gnostics, Adam and the garden are not somewhere physical or even material. That's in like the world above worlds, above the abode of the sun and the moon. And it's pre-manifest. And we all manifest from that.
That's why my whole theory that Kether is just like a hard rock of cocaine and we're just like little breaks off of that solid pure.
That's not un-Gnostic. That's very close to what their idea is about Adam and Adam and Kadmon and the Son of Man and all that stuff.
Yeah, and the word mesla means like the flow or like the dripping from heaven, and it's just like perfect. The yeah. Flaming sword is the very action of going through the tree of life in order. It's like a line of cocaine from heaven. It's beautiful.
I want some.
Don't you get too high.
Now I'm having fun.
But yeah, God is a big-ass crack rock in heaven. The purest crack.
Uncut.
But you're a cut of it somehow. We're pure too.
Are you saying that you just got to find that inner crack within you?
Yes.
And crack is now synonymous with Jesus, so yes.
Oh my God.
Wow.
That's why times are so tough down here. We've got a little piece of God in our soul just with a ton of foot powder sprinkled on top.
I think this is why when people get high off of crazy shit, like crack, they just start talking about the Bible and God. They're probably not wrong.
That would explain it.
Yeah, that's my theory.
Okay, Mars, hit us with verse 67.
Jesus said, "Those who know all but are lacking in themselves are utterly lacking."
According to Gnostic Jesus, we profit less from knowing everything about the world than we do knowing a little about ourselves. After all, according to Gnostic cosmology, the human soul is but a spark of the Pleroma, a word that means fullness and represents the heavenly world of reality beyond the shoddy, simulated foot powder world of physical matter created by the abortive demiurge. Likewise, we ought to seek to rejoin with it. In some versions of Gnostic cosmology, it is the Sophia who breathes the spark of life into the clay bodies fashioned by this mad spiritual tyrant Yaldabaoth, the demiurge. In this way, Sophia is likened to our own soul. Her name itself means wisdom, and her Hebrew equivalent, therefore, is Chokmah, the first Sephira on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life to split off from the unity of Kether, the crown.
You know, come to think of it, if Adam is Kether, the rib would be the first emanation of him, which creates Eve or Sophia. Because prior to the emanation of Chokmah, Kether is like, it's not passive and it's not active. It's sort of neither. And when it overflows, it becomes Chokmah, and it's conceptualized as the relationship between a point and a line. So in this case, the line would be the rib and Chokmah would be Eve. So
ribs in heaven.
Ribs. Got the itis.
I want my baby back, baby back, baby back. I want my baby back, baby back, baby
Chili's.
Back. Baby back ribs, barbecue sauce.
I got the itis.
My butt. So this movement out of Kether on the Tree of Life reflects the Gnostic cosmology, where Sophia initiated creation on accident by a yearning to emanate without her pair or syzygy. Think Barbie or Ken. And honestly, I'm 100% sure that whoever made that Barbie movie did have this exact idea in mind. I swear by it. Anyway, now, as she emanated from the Pleroma without her syzygy, she fell into darkness. Now, in fear of losing her life and in anguish to return to the Pleroma or fullness, she accidentally gave birth to Yaldabaoth, which means son of chaos, or elsewhere known as the Demiurge, a word which in its native Greek means public artificer. It was this demiurge who created the material world and placed above us the archons as tyrannical rulers over our destiny. To the Gnostics, Jesus Christ was sent by the Pleroma to help free us from this black iron prison, as it is sometimes referred to, and ultimately redeem his bride, the Sophia. If we look back again to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, we see this in a less anthropomorphic form. When Sophia or Chokmah emanates from Kether, in so doing, it creates Bina, the Sephira on the Tree of Life associated with a primordial womb, which ensouls the light of Chokmah into forms which are born into the world and return there again in death. Likewise, according to some Kabbalistic writings, the material world of Malkuth, the world we live in, is thought to rest upon Bina's lap. Even without the moral dogmas of the Gnostics overlaid upon it, the idea behind the Tree of Life is to reascend back towards the fullness of the higher reaches of the tree, which likewise correspond to the higher, more rarefied abodes of heaven, the ones that won't pass away, according to Jesus. And so now that you know this, you can quit your day job and begin seeking Sophia full-time. Of course, fair warning, if you do, you will be hated and persecuted. Don't say I didn't warn you. You know why they gave Ken the big fluffy jacket in Barbie? It's because of Yaldabaoth's lion-like mane. Okay, I'm done. Go watch the damn movie.
Okay, verse 68, Jesus said, "Congratulations to you when you are hated and persecuted, and no place will be found wherever you have been persecuted."
All right, it sounds like I'm doing exactly what Jesus wants.
Yeah. Me too.
For once.
This verse, like a few others, comes off a bit strange. Academics relate it to Luke 6, line 22 through 23, and Matthew 5, lines 10 through 12, which congratulates Christians for the persecution they will necessarily face, where, in both verses, Jesus Christ offers that it is due to him whom the world has rejected. Like, you're friends with me, and so the world hates me, and so they're going to hate you. Therefore, to be wrongly persecuted is evidence of, contrary to what one may first think, that God actually loves you. If you got haters, it's because God is favoring you.
I don't know. I think he's gaslighting us, but talk about that some other time.
Nah, it's just like, you know, how the goth or emo kids would act. It's like, everyone make fun of me, but that means I'm cooler than all them. Like, that's the vibe I'm getting from Jesus.
Those people made fun of me.
Well, I'm using an example of a clique. Yeah, I was like the bottom tier, but yeah.
Bunch of hipster haters.
My group was so lame that, like, we didn't even really have a stereotype. It was like literally all the rejects from every clique.
Yeah, chilling with the nerds and the rejects is where it's at.
And Jesus said, go play magic cards in the quad.
And we played Yu-Gi-Oh.
An anime club is at 7 o'clock.
Then we'll watch Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail.
Oh, sounds sick.
So in terms of the sentiment in this verse, we see it also in the canonical gospels, especially in Matthew 5, 9 through 11.
Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. I guess if everyone hates you, you're doing something right. And honestly, it's just so realistic in my opinion, because even in real life, if you're successful and you're doing all the right things, you're going to get tons of haters because they're just jealous of you and what you have.
There's something right about what you're doing if literally everyone else is against you. There has to be something right there.
There's something kind of reassuring about this where if you're being persecuted and hated for doing what feels right to you in your heart, it's kind of reassuring to me, at least, to be like, well, you're on the right path.
Now, as we've pointed out, a similar verse exists in Luke and Matthew. However, what's different here in the Gospels of Thomas, it seems to be there's some negative or even vengeful consequences for the wrongful persecutor. While academics are not entirely certain what no place will be found actually means, we do know that elsewhere in Thomas, the general idea of a place is frequently in relation to the idea of salvation. As such, it may be suggested here that when somebody is martyred for their faith, the ground upon which their blood was spilt may become accursed. This idea is not entirely alien to mainstream religion, which often holds that the grave sites of holy people tend to become holy sites, and those of evil or bloodthirsty people tend to become accursed ground. One interesting example is the Green Dome in Medina, which is said to hold the burial site of Muhammad, two caliphs, and one empty spot, which is reserved for none other than Isa ibn Maryam, more popularly known in the West as Jesus Christ, should he return and require a final resting spot. This place is so sacred that it's a traditional bonus quest alongside the pilgrimage to Mecca, which each Muslim is required to accomplish at least once in their life, if able. On the flip side, an Ehud Netzer spent over 30 years attempting to track down King Herod's resting place. In 2010, he finally found it. However, during the same trip to Herodium, he suffered a debilitating fall, which sent him to the hospital where he died 3 days later. The newspapers which reported the death were quick to relate it to the centuries-old belief in the curse of Herod's resting place.
Yeah, as a skeptic of crazy phenomena like that happening, when stuff like that is in the news or I hear about it, it's like, well...
And isn't it ironic? Don't you think? It's like rain!
Yeah, that shit was cursed by fucking evil. Of course. Those demons.
I mean, this dude spent his whole career, the majority of his life, looking for Herod's gravesite, and the minute he found it, it killed him. And then I think in India, there's a gravesite for Mother Mary, maybe even Jesus Christ, which are considered holy sites. And it just goes on and on. It's a big thing in religion. So maybe this verse is saying, if they throw rocks at your head and you die, then the bad guys are going to slip and fall in that spot for the rest of eternity. I don't know. I don't know if that's what it's saying. Nobody really knows what that line means. Which brings us, of course, to verse 69, Elon Musk's favorite verse.
Aw, yeah.
You got to put some, you know, horns.
Sexy music on top of this.
Of course, when it's Jesus stuff we're talking about, they just become Pisces fish.
Jesus said, congratulations to those who have been persecuted in their hearts. They are the ones who have truly come to know the Father. Congratulations to those who go hungry, so the stomach of the one in want may be filled.
When it comes to salvation, less is more. As Clement of Alexandria once said, the most difficult persecution is from within, from pleasures and passions. The one being persecuted cannot escape it, for he carries the enemy around with himself everywhere. Even the Buddha was thought to have declared that if two desires were as potent as the lust for sex, then nobody would ever become enlightened, even him.
So for him, it was like sex or nothing. That's the only...
He's saying of like all the temptations, all of the bodily, material, sensorial indulgences that obscure the path to enlightenment, nothing gets even close to sex. And if there was, it would be impossible. That's how bad lust is, according to the Buddha.
I think this line ties in with the previous one that talks about no place will be found. So to me, that's the ground upon which your gnosis is founded, which serves as a seat of your spiritual being. And those who persecute that of you have not discovered the same ground. If you take a Kemetic clue, the seat of your spiritual being is your heart. And this line refers to persecution in their hearts. So this line and the one similar to it found in the Bible feels very reminiscent to me of a chapter one verse in the Book of the Law, where Nuit says, "This is the creation of the world, that the pain of division is as nothing, and the joy of dissolution all." In essence, the pain of being divided or left in want is nothing compared to the ecstasy of union with God. The feeling of fulfillment being perfection is all-encompassing, similar to that of a starving person who is suddenly given an all-you-can-eat buffet. I think the persecution of the heart that is brought up is also of particular interest. We can discover who we truly are through our trials in life. Persecution of the heart can lead us to opportunities of self-reflection, shadow work, and through these trials and coming to know our true naked selves, we come to know God. The word want itself has two relationships. One relates to the desire or wish for something, and the other implies a lack of or deficiency of something, as in to be left in want is to be deficient of that thing. So this ties into earlier verses where Jesus says, "There are days you will seek him and you will not find him." It's all duat, dark night of the soul stuff to me. And this for me is confirmed by the next part of the verse that brings up the stomach. So again, if you look to Egyptian symbolism, the stomach was guarded by the jackal-headed Duamutef, and he was associated with the east, the place where the sun rises from the duat, that's the darkness, right? And his name means he who worships his mother. And like the other four sons of Horus, they were all born from a lotus flower in the fashion of Nefertem. I hope that made sense.
So this crazy stomach dog was born from a flower?
Yeah, that's the whole lotus flower symbolism that we went into in the last episode. I just think it's really fascinating because his name means he who worships his mother, and one of his primary roles is actually in worshiping the dead. So this would be the deceased in the books of the dead. And we know that this entire journey through the duat culminates in the eventual weighing of the heart against the soul, and the heart being the heart of my mother is what it's usually referred to. And so this kind of fulfillment, the stomach of the one in want may be filled, I feel like that's all very in line with this ideology.
It's always a little scary how much this stuff goes back to Egypt. This brings us to one of my favorite lines, verse 70.
Jesus said, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you have will save you. If you do not have that within you, what you do not have within you will kill you."
I'd always thought that this verse read a little differently and suggested that integrating one's shadow would save you while refusing to do so would result in your destruction. Apparently, scholars have a much more straightforward interpretation of this verse. According to scholars Funk and Hoover, this saying reminded the fellows of the Gnostic idea that one's salvation depends on possessing, a recognizing in oneself, a piece of the divine sacred spark, a fragment of the light, which signals one's true origin in the one high God, the ultimate source of the other divinities, including the creator God. If one possesses it and recognizes it, salvation is assured. Noting Gospels of Thomas 24, line 3, where the same idea is said explicitly. If one does not possess the divine spark, there is nothing one can do about it.
I think that the scholarly interpretation still plays well with the shadow work concept. I like what you were saying about the shadow work stuff. I think it ties really well into the duat journey. And if you want to think of bringing forth what is within you as being like raw, going through the duat, your consciousness, and then the harmonization of shadow work being through the gates, through the duat with all the demons and the slaying of Apep, it does have a bit of a feeling as well of separating the wheat from the chaff. I think it plays on the emerging from the duat and rebirth as a new sun or consciousness concept.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could see it both ways because, you know, even towards the beginning, we were discussing putting on garments or whatever, like the whole idea of wearing an ego, and that this kind of looking into yourself for the spark of divinity inside of your ego, and then the bringing it forth would be to like go through everything that makes you who you are to bring that spark of divinity forth and out of yourself. Like you do have to confront these things and go through your shadow work in order to recognize that in yourself.
Right. It's like saying the best light workers are the ones who have done the shadow work. Like if you're just solely focusing on the light work, you're only looking at the daylight. You're not going through the nighttime. And the rebirth of the consciousness, it's complete only if you go through the nighttime as well.
And I would argue you wouldn't even be able to recognize God within yourself if you do not go through both.
Yeah, I agree.
This pairs pretty well with the last verse then, because you're supposed to feel persecuted in your heart. I guess because you're the one doing the persecuting. You're the one who's giving yourself a tough time and doing the shadow work so you can bring forth the inner light within you once it's discovered. And you can't stop looking for pearls just because you're allergic to clams. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the last line here of line 70, what you do not have within you will kill you. Easy to say, you know, your weakness will probably be your downfall. A lot like how Achilles had a weakness, you know, you could bring down even the most divine beings, and we're a fragment of that divinity, and we're only going to fall to our weaknesses. It's kind of a simple saying at the very end there, but you have to recognize the important part is that you're a part of the divinity. So going through the shadow work is going to help you be strong and cover your weaknesses and ascend.
See, because to bring it forth sounds like effort. It sounds like you got to do some lifting and some pulling or some holding or some throwing or something. And if you don't have it, you're going to die. You have to pull the sword from the stone because the zombies are coming and you got to chop their heads off. That's how it works, right? The Merlin with an owl. I don't know.
Got to have a warehouse full of stuff. You know, apocalypse is coming.
Well, speaking of a warehouse full of stuff, this brings us to verse 71. Hit it, Mari.
Jesus said, I will destroy this house and no one will be able to build it.
Woo! On the one hand, this verse may indicate that this house is none other than the material world of the Matrix itself, that Christ is kindling a fire that will burn the whole thing down. More scholarly, Bible-flavored interpretation is that Christ is referring specifically to the Jewish temple, which, by the time the era arrives in which Thomas was written, well, it's still gone unbuilt for about 100 years, maybe 200 years. And if that's the case, this may be why the versions of the saying in the Synoptic Gospels often reflect the sentiment that the temple will be rebuilt in 3 days. Because to them, back in the old days, that goal was still somewhere on the horizon. But by the time the Gospels of Thomas were a thing, that ship had long since sailed, and this verse is meant to reflect that. The temple's destroyed, it's not coming back. The end. In fact, it's still quite a snafu today, because where the site that the third temple of Jerusalem is supposed to be built is now where the Muslim-controlled Al-Aqsa Mosque stands today, more commonly known as the Dome of the Rock, and it contains a giant slab of land, or a big rock, from which Muhammad is said to have been assumed into heaven during his night journey, or his meeting with God, to put it simply. To both Jews and Muslims, however, it's also the place where God created the world, gave birth to Adam, and where Abraham almost sacrificed his first son. So, kind of a big deal. As you can imagine, control over this specific spot in the Holy Land is still a considerable source of conflict to this day, and the third temple of Jerusalem has yet to be built.
I like to think of the whole 3 days thing as being symbolic of, you know, three periods of time you have past, present, and future, and the rebuilding of which would be the syncretism of the three together into a holistic one. But I'm going to take this verse into Jungian territory, where in his book Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Carl Jung wrote, "A man who has not passed through the inferno of his passions has never overcome them. They then dwell in the house next door, and at any moment a flame may dart out and set fire to his own house. Whenever we give up, leave behind, and forget too much, there is always the danger that the things we have neglected will return with added force."
Oh, good job, Carl Jung, making the complicated simple.
By applying what Jung is saying to this verse, we can understand that the alchemical flames of transmutation, which Jesus is very much symbolic of, will either burn away aspects of one's personality or, if avoided, consume them. So the house represents one's domain, and in the case of an ego death, those unmitigated flames of our passions will carry on to destroy the new ego if one does not overcome them himself. You know, this is like pattern repetition. So embodying Christ consciousness, we destroy the house of our own volition, and no ego will be able to build it in the same old fashion.
I think that makes perfectly good sense. And it relates to what we discussed in the intro, that Christ is changing the world. So it's not necessarily that the world's going to burn down. It's just you can't step in the same river twice. You know what I mean? So likewise, the changes that Jesus is making to the world is going to make it so we can't go back to the old version. He's doing the Windows update. He's installing a whole new version of Windows, maybe even a new operating system. And the old one is dead. It's burned down. No one will ever bring it back.
It's all going to be Linux. Open source.
Yeah. Verse 72, a person said to him, tell my brothers to divide my father's possessions with me. He said to the person, Mister, who made me a divider? He turned to his disciples and said to them, I am not a divider, am I?
Are you drunk, Jesus?
Yeah. What happened? Earlier he said he was going to turn everyone against each other. Did I say that?
I wouldn't do that, Ossifer. Not me. I'm Jesus. Son of God. You know God, don't you, Ossifer?
This is cool, dude. It's my dad.
Call my dad! Call my dad! Now, a similar story occurs in Luke 12, line 13 through 21. But in this section, Jesus uses the opportunity to remind the brother that having great possessions will not assure one's life. In the Gospels of Thomas, Christ uses this opportunity to muse on the nature of his mission. While we have been warned that Christ has come to burn down the world, destroy houses, and set families against each other, his primary role is still unifier between people and the Heavenly Father. So he's not a divider where it matters. Where it matters, he's a unifier.
I mean, this is very much in line with the ideology regarding the unification of Horus and Set. That would be the divider, typically. But even the divider is willingly unified as one, right? And works towards the union and the rebirth.
That being Set? The divider being Set?
Yeah. I mean, you look at the Waset and it ends in two prongs, right? And the idea of wielding the Waset is that you use this power in a unified way.
It makes extra special sense if Malachor's theory that the Christians are just esoteric Setians, maybe even the Hebrews are esoteric Setians, then that really works. Anyone who has big floppy Set ears better listen.
Yeah.
Verse 73, Jesus said, the crop is huge, but the workers are few, so beg the harvest boss to dispatch workers to the fields.
And that's how the UFOs got here. Jokes aside, once again, we find another verse relating the world to a farm. In this case, it would seem that once again, the owner of the field is related to the Heavenly Father, who, wishing to reap the divine sparks trapped within us, is asked to dispatch more prophets, saints, and messengers to accomplish a greater yield of salvation. This pairs well with the last statement, as we may assume Jesus is just another one of these workers who is gathering together the harvest of souls on his father's behalf. Like, he's separating the wheat from the chaff, but he's gathering that wheat, all right.
Verse 74, he said, Lord, there are many around the drinking trough, but there is nothing in the well.
This seems like a shorter version of the alternately drunk and thirsty inhabitants of the world from line 28, and may be a variant of a Greek mystery saying attributed to Plato, which goes, the wand bearers are many, but the initiates are few. This was also true of the 2010s. According to Celsus, the same phrase was found in a work by the Ophites, who are serpent worshippers, and a text called Heavenly Dialogue, and it says, why are there many around the well and no one in the well? This, like the next verse in Thomas, sounds like an ancient version of the phrase, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. Drink the water, you stupid horse! Drink it! Drink the water!
There's an interesting line from Twin Peaks that goes, this is the water, this is the well, drink full and descend. What David Lynch means by that, we don't quite know, but I think it applies to this idea.
God, what else could it apply to, right? It's a little bit like the bridal chamber, you know, everyone's outside of it, but like only the single ones can go in. Oh, but wait a minute, that whole idea comes up in the next line. Maybe we're onto something. You have to go in the well, okay? Don't be like Samara and have your mom throw you in. You gotta go diving in. You gotta be like Steve-O, right? Just go.
Might break some bones, but you don't need bones where we're going.
Exactly.
Verse 75, Jesus said, there are many standing at the door, but those who are alone will enter the bridal suite. Ooh, wow, wow.
I guess I was getting a little ahead of myself. I thought that was behind us. It's actually in front of us. So, well, this seems similar to sentiment expressed by the phrase, many are called, few are chosen. This verse may further indicate the formula of Gnostic salvation, where unity and oneness with the divine light is paramount. While chastity may be hinted at here, it seems just as likely that those who are alone are those who have found total unity with God, who are one with, and simultaneously above all the other things. Likewise, as with the war engine in the third chapter of the Book of the Law, the many may stand metaphorically for a plurality of thought or focus, as much as it does the rabble one is made to be separate from as a Gnostic. So like you may have all these thoughts or whims or ideas or aspects of your personality, but none of them are going down deep enough into the source. You have to like isolate the part of you that is willing to go there, perhaps.
I kind of like to think of the, you know, in the bridal suite, you have the bride and groom alone together, and the bride being Nuit,
and the groom being Hadith. So that would be the one aspect of yourself in a private union. And in Jewish tradition, the bridal suite is called the Yichud. I probably murdered that pronunciation, but it means together.
Oh!
And it's the first time after the couple are wed that they're alone. So the bridal suite is typically a private room, and it's traditional for several guests to stay outside the room to guard it to ensure the newlyweds' privacy. If you relate this concept to the things that we've talked about so far, the many earthly aspects of ourselves, our personalities, etc., are not what are married, but they are charged with standing guard to protect that union.
Oh,
that's a cool job.
You know, it could also be applied to the marriage of the Holy Guardian Angel as Christ consciousness, or an alchemical marriage of the self, which leaves behind the impurities and unites with God. And it's a very personal gnosis thing again. And the bridal suite would be metaphorically hermetically sealed in this sense.
I think your interpretation actually makes the most sense here.
I agree, because it reminds me of what you were saying in the beginning of this episode about kind of pouring yourself into the chalice and giving it up. You know, that's what Christ mentality is talking about. That's what the hermetic formula is referencing, is this pouring into the chalice, all your ego to, you know, make contact with your true self, your guardian angel, and integrate it into your magical journey.
Well, and also, like, if you think of the path from Tiferet to Kether, and you have the empress that goes across, you know, at the bottom of the triangle at the top of the tree of life, and you have her association with the door, and all those aspects of yourself aren't allowed past that.
Oh, that's true.
They have to stay behind.
I think you cracked the code on this one. So it's more crossing the abyss stuff, but, you know, in ancient desert motifs. So, like, instead of the chalice of Babylon, you have the well, and all the blood that usually you would pour into the chalice in this example, because of Jewish tradition, all of those extra personalities or those other parts of self are now guarding your union with the divine on the inside. That's a really interesting way to look at it.
I think it's correct.
Well, and if this text deals a lot with, you know, union with God, a seat at the table of the Father's banquet, then of course, if you look at it in the, you know, from the Tree of Life perspective, it's going to have a lot to do with crossing the abyss. So I think that's why it's coming up so much, is this text is very much related to that.
Jesus said, "The Father's kingdom is like a merchant who had a supply of merchandise and found a pearl. That merchant was prudent. He sold the merchandise and bought the single pearl for himself. So also with you, seek his treasure that is unfailing, that is enduring, where no moth comes to eat and no worm destroys."
This first line strongly resembles a verse in Matthew 13:45, which goes,
"Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man seeking goodly pearls, who when he had found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it."
The overall idea is that what God has to offer us is greater than anything else we could ever own, and we should seize any opportunity to achieve unity with the Father, even unto shunning all that we have, especially our worldly or professional attachments. Here, like in our metaphor of the Father sowing seeds, we are met once again with the threat of hell's worm finding the opportunity to consume us. While the evils of the world can readily consume us alongside our works and accomplishments, it can do no such thing to our spiritual accomplishments or unity with God. But if you'd like to buy the rest of this episode, which is a pearl of great price of $5, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5, Mr. Merchant Man, will not get you just the extended version of this show, not just the extended version of all our Gospels of Thomas shows, but the extended version of all our episodes, which are, once you integrate with Patreon, browsable right from within Spotify, which is convenient as hell. Besides that, I'll send you a 5x5 high quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art, which I just restocked on, and we're not cheap. And even more than that, I will send you the secret Jesus fish, which will point to our hidden Gnostic digital catacombs, where we do spooky Gnostic rituals with the giant goats.
Can we talk about wamens and wombs and bread?
Oh, we will speak of many loaves. But first, we have to eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.